bottom of the heap. There was a workhouse in Lichfield Street. There was also a children's workhouse. They didn't call it that. They wouldn't dream of calling it that. But there was an asylum for the infant poor, which was effectively a children's workhouse, and it stood in Summer Lane, where Newtown Shopping Centre is today. And if you added those two populations together, you've got about 1,000 people. On top of that, about 6,000 people were receiving what was called out relief. That is, they were receiving benefit of some kind. We've come up with all sorts of different names for this: family allowance, family credit, unemployment pay, since. But in the 19th century, it was called out payments or out relief. And there were about 6,000 people receiving that. And on top of that, there were huge numbers, an unquantifiable number of people who never went in search of relief to the officials who granted it, who were known as overseers of the poor. And a lot of people wouldn't drop their dignity to actually go cap in hand to the parish. And so they struggled on by, you know, trying to find bits of work, by pawning their furniture every Monday and then collecting it back at the weekend when they got paid, and so on, and lived, you know, hand to mouth, week to week. And, you know, that's by far the largest number of people who were poor in the 19th century, and those official records really only scratch the surface of it. It goes up and down. There were periods when Birmingham in general was a wealthy city. It was comfortably off. The working classes were, in general, better paid, better housed than people from Manchester, Liverpool, probably London. Work was more plentiful, wages were better. But work in Birmingham, especially a town that relied on the market and selling things, and on fashion, jewellery and cufflinks and the kind of things that used to be called toys, metal, little metal objects, snuff boxes and chains and earrings and all sorts. That it tended to go in sequences. There'd be an up and then there'd be a down. And somebody who was doing quite well at one time would suddenly be out of work the next week and struggling. And so Birmingham was used to very uneven levels of poverty. Yeah. And very few could actually find ways of saving enough to bolster them through the bad times. So it was an up and down. And the worst time, which is actually where a lot of the best records revolve around, was the late 1830s. That was a really bad time in the British economy and in Birmingham's economy. The previous worst was in the 1790s, when Britain was at war with France and all exports to Europe ceased. And it's exports is really important because roughly three quarters of everything Birmingham produced was for export, either to America or to Europe by the middle of the 19th century. We were absolutely dependent on trade with Europe and the Americas and wider. So when that got clammed up by war, a lot of people were out of work. And there's a place at the back of here called Vaughton's Hole, and it's a little bend in the River Ray. And it was the suicide spot for out of work businessmen for about a century. The water was deep there because of the bend in the river, and they were almost queuing up at Vaughton's Hole at various times to commit suicide in bad times. They was forever dragging people out the river. As it happens, the Ray marks the boundary between two parishes, Birmingham the one side, Aston the other. And it depended which side of the river you were washed up on as to whose parish responsibility was to bury you. So it was said that some of the parish officials used to push them off so that they came back up on the other bank. So if you're out of work, you were in theory entitled to some kind of relief, out relief. And that depended on how many children you had, whether you were a single parent, etc., etc. And it also depended, and the reason why I've introduced it tonight is that it also depended on your what was called parish of settlement. And that said, and this went back to the poor laws of the Queen Elizabeth I, that the parish that was responsible for looking after you, if you were poor, disabled, ill, elderly, was your parish of settlement. And that was either the parish you were born in or the parish where you'd worked for at least 12 months, which gave you settlement in that place. Or the parish where you rented a house above a certain level of rent. That was what determined which part of the country, which parish was responsible for you. And the worst employers, and there were a hell of a lot of them, particularly in agricultural areas, who used to pay labourers for 51 weeks in the year so that they wouldn't get settlement. They didn't have 52 weeks, which would have given them settlement in that little village, wherever it was. So settlement was really important because, you know, when you were down and out or when you were out of work, whose responsibility was it to look after you? It was your home, wherever that happens to be. And of course, this greatly affects anyone coming to Birmingham from elsewhere, whether they were Irish or Jewish or Welsh or Italian. And so on. So that's been my research over the last few years. And when Anne approached me about giving a talk here, I thought that's really nice because I want, along the way, I've been picking up lots about the different communities because generally poverty fell hardest on people who were newly arrived in Birmingham more heavily than on people who were settled here for generations. So it picks up along the way quite a lot about the different communities in Birmingham. And Birmingham, as we all know, and it's now a kind of a badge of pride, has always been, or for a very long time, a mixed community of lots of different people from different places. There's a bit of a race on now to become the first city in Britain to have more than 50% population who are non-white. And Birmingham, I think, is at the head of that race, though Leicester, I think, is close behind. And they say within, you know, very few years, that more than half the population of Birmingham won't be white. That's considerable, but it's also been true that for centuries, Birmingham has been a place of settlers. Let's face it, first people who came and settled here, probably somewhere by the River Ray, were Germans. They were Anglo-Saxons. So we've always been a place of mixed communities. But it's really noticeable by the end of the 18th century, when there were populations of Irish, Welsh, some black people. I've picked up a few of those along the line, and Jews and a few Italians later and so on. So it's always been a bit of a mixture. And my first little bit of evidence for that is the census. If you've done family history, you know something about the census. We all fill it in every 10 years, of course. And the census records the names of everyone, at least it has since 1841. But the amount of information they put on the census changes over period. And in that first census, which has names attached in 1841, it doesn't put where someone was born, as you would now. It just says whether you were born in Warwickshire or not. Birmingham being in Warwickshire until 1974. And the figure for Birmingham in 1841 was that, oh. 43% were not born in the county. 43% of people living in Birmingham weren't born in Warwickshire. And I know it's difficult to get your head around that figure, what's that mean? But I, just for a comparison, I looked at Coventry in the same date, 1841, and only 18% of people who lived in Coventry weren't born in Warwickshire. So Birmingham, right from that date and before, always had a lot of people who weren't originally from the place. And at that date, if you want a figure for the Irish, it said that 4,683 Irish-born residents were living in Birmingham and Aston and Edgbaston. Aston and Edgbaston weren't part of Birmingham at that date. Edgbaston just was, actually. But Aston doesn't become part of Birmingham until 1912. So, but you know, it's a much wider area now than it was then. But there was something like 5,000 Irish living in Birmingham at that date. So my sources for finding out about that Irish community, which was very much a changing community, there's about three or four. There are the records of the poor law, and that's the people who dispensed relief or took others into the workhouse. They were called overseers, although later on they also had guardians of the poor who were elected by the voters of Birmingham to look after the workhouse and the system around it. So there are good records for there. There are the newspapers that I started with. And there are other things like missionary diaries. In the 1830s, there was a real push to convert or reach the dark back streets of Birmingham. The belief was that Birmingham was full of heathens, just as many heathens as you'd find in Africa. So at the same date as they're sending missionaries out to darkest Africa, they're sending missionaries out to darkest Digbeth as well. And it was quite competitive. There were the three churches that were doing this mainly were the Methodists, although sadly few of the Methodist records survived for that early. The Congregationalists, whose main church was up at Carr's Lane, and the Unitarians, whose main church was at the new meeting house, which is now a Catholic church on Moore Street. And they were sending out missionaries, paid missionaries, to knock on doors, go into the courts of the back streets of the poorest parts of the town to get them to subscribe to Bibles, receive tracts, come to Sunday school, come to church or to chapel, and so on. And the missionaries had to submit weekly diaries of their reports to the church officials, who read them, corrected them, and you know, agreed them. And quite a few of those diaries survive. They're an extraordinary insight into the lives of those people who wouldn't be recorded in any other shape or form. They describe the interiors of houses, what people are eating, when they last ate, and so on. And there are about four diaries that survive from the town mission, the Congregationalist mission, including one who you may have heard of before, called Finnegan's Diary, which Jim will tell you was dutifully transcribed a few years ago, because his handwriting is typically Victorian, it's bloody awful. And his diary has been transcribed, and you can read the transcript rather than having to wrestle with the original handwriting. Finnegan's is an interesting one because he was Irish. He was a convert to the Protestant Church from Catholic, and he was sent into the poor Irish quarter because he understood Gaelic. He spoke Gaelic, and a lot of the people in that quarter wouldn't have understood him otherwise. And he gets some stick for that, has to be said, particularly because the majority, not all, but the majority of the Irish there are Catholic. So converting Catholics is kind of a, you know, great thing to try and do to those Unitarians and Congregationalists. They usually fail, but and sometimes they give up. They say, well, Park Street's just not worth having a go at because it's all Catholics in there. We've got no chance. It's a bit like, you know, we used to get regular visits from the Mormons and the Jehovah's Witnesses in our street. I live in edge of Bullsall Heath, Moseley. And the easiest way to get rid of them was to say you were a Catholic. Because they knew there was no chance they could convert you. Nowadays they don't come down the street because it's 90% Muslim. So they've given up on our neighbourhood. But these missionaries, Mr. Clay and Mr. Sibrey and Mr. Finnegan, went into these areas. They had to keep records of how many houses they visited every day, how many families they visited, and occasionally they get sucked into social issues, almost campaigning, and that's when they're reprimanded by the church elders for meddling in politics. They begin to recognise that, you know, there are streets in Birmingham which are ruined not because of religion but because of poverty and people being out of work, and they begin to write to newspapers sometimes about this and collect statistics of poverty and unemployment and so on, and that's when often they're elbowed aside or put in order and things. So that's one of the great sources for the Irish. The streets, the Irish Quarter in the time that Finnegan and Clay and Sibrey and so on, the missionaries are going out into the streets with their tracts and their Bibles. In the 1830s, the Irish Quarter is a relatively small area of streets most of the time, and I bought, not using PowerPoint tonight, it's nice to have a break from that. I'll be starting that soon enough once term starts. But I brought a map along, if I'll pass it on in a minute if you want to see. If you can imagine, the street map of Birmingham, central Birmingham, has changed quite a bit, mainly because of the arrival of Corporation Street. Corporation Street was cut in the 1870s as part of what was called the Improvement Scheme under Joseph Chamberlain. There was no street where Corporation Street now heads down off New Street. New Street was just a solid row of houses there and shops and so on. Corporation Street cut through that, through a maze of little streets until it reached Old Square, which still stands. Old Square is still there, next to where Lewis's used to be, but is now Magistrates Courts. And then Corporation Street followed the line of Lichfield Street beyond Old Square, down towards, you know, what's now Aston University and Lancaster Circus and so on. So it's only the bottom bit of Corporation Street that actually follows an old street line. And Lichfield Street, as I mentioned, was where the workhouse was on the left, just halfway down it. So just about all the streets that the Irish are particularly associated with in the earliest period, in the 1810s and 20s, and early 30s, are streets that were wiped from the map as part of that improvement scheme. Not surprisingly, the improvement scheme was what was called a permissive act of Parliament. It meant that local authorities could adopt it or not, depending on how they felt about it. But it gave the local authorities the power to sweep away houses and streets and courts if the death rate in those streets and courts was above a certain level. That if it was above a certain level, you had the power to wipe it. And very few places, to be honest, took up the act. But Birmingham was one which was Birmingham was very ambitious in the 1870s. Joseph Chamberlain was kicking it up the backside, and it went for it. And so the streets that were swept away were the ones that were poor and derelict and disease-ridden. The worst street for death rate was Hospital Street, ironically. And just about the most polluted was called Oxygen Street. There's an irony in that. But the streets where the Irish are mentioned in the newspapers and in the missionary diaries and so on, streets that have gone, but I'll mention them. Slaney Street is one that's eventually mentioned. It doesn't turn up till the later 1830s. John Street, London Prentice Street, or London Apprentice Street, Thomas Street, and those in particular. And if you imagine Steelhouse Lane running down towards Lancaster Circus, and Lichfield Street running in the same direction, it's those streets in between the two. It's those streets where the Irish were principally living, and quite large numbers of them. But it's also said, and the records seem to show, that the Irish population was very migratory. It was there for the summer, and then often it was gone in the winter. And it seems to be that quite a lot of Irish men come over in the late spring, early summer, for agricultural work, particularly on the harvest. So they would come to Birmingham, spend, a few days in the city. Then they'd go off, probably walking, to find work with a farmer, gathering in the harvest. And then, having earned a few bob, you could do reasonably well in those few weeks of harvest. Farmers were desperate, of course, to get the harvest in, given the English weather. He didn't want to risk leaving it or taking long over it. So they were willing to pay pretty good wages to those Irish workers, certainly more than they'd be getting back on the other side of the Irish Sea. So they do pretty well for 2 or 3 weeks. Then they come back into Birmingham, and they'd lodge here and usually spend quite a lot of the money before they went back to Ireland. And birds of passage they're described as in one report. It was a medical officer whose name was Dr. John Darwell, whose father, as it happens, was the vicar or the minister at St. John Derrit End, which was the medieval church that sat right next to the Irish Centre here. It was bombed in the war and knocked down, but there used to be a chapel or church, Anglican church, just here. And that was the Reverend Darwell, and his son became a doctor who got very interested in issues of public health, spent a lot of time working at the Birmingham Dispensary, which was a kind of poor chemist's for the town. So he was very aware of pockets of ill health, and most of the doctors, generally Birmingham was thought of as quite a healthy town, again compared with Manchester and Liverpool and London, and the doctors always say, that they never get fever in Birmingham except when foreigners bring it in. I think they were so worried about their own reputation that might be associated with poor health. They tended to be very protective about the health in Birmingham. So they nearly always associate fever, cholera, typhus with incomers, whether those be Irish or just across the border from the Black Country. They tend to do it. And Darwell says quite a lot about the low Irish, is his phrase, living in places like London Prentice Street, where fever prevails, he says. And if fever prevailed there, it certainly spread fast, simply because in that period during the summer, when quite a lot of migrant workers come to Birmingham for a few weeks or a few months. They live very close to each other. Somebody who owns a back-to-back house in Thomas Street, John Street, say, recognises that is the time to make your money. Your rent will probably be in a house in John Street in the 1830s, about 15p a week, 3 shillings a week. Now, if you can rent bed space in that house for several weeks, you can, your quid's in. You can cover your rent for the next 6 months by renting bed space, and that's what a lot did. They it's said that often 15 to 20 people will stay in one of those back-to-back houses. If you imagine the back-to-backs in Hurst Street, 3 rooms or possibly even 2 rooms plus a kitchen, that is going to be quite, you know, intensely crowded. And people who would be staying there would pay on average 3 pence a night, 3 old pence a night for a bed, and possibly a meal. It's difficult to get to the bottom of this, and nobody really spells out the finances of it. I think some houses said, you know, bed and board, but it really, you know, you get some sort of evening meal. You wouldn't get breakfast or something like that, but you might get a meal thrown in with the threepence a night. Well, threepence a night, 7 nights a week, 20 people. You can see, you know, can be quite a profitable arrangement. But, you know, it might only work for a few months, and then your house is empty again for the next few months. But when people were living that close together, there was always friction, and very often ill health that followed from it. How are we going for time? 20 past. What time would you like me to speak?
What did I say? Just because we asked the end.
You might. Oh, okay. All right. Okay. Fine.
Roughly.
Okay. Fine. So that very often turns up then in the newspaper reports, and what regularly happens is a lodger in one of these houses gets robbed by someone in the same house, and there's a nice description here. I'll read you from one of the papers. This was from May 1827, and Michael Leach, whose name is, was in a house in London Prentice Street, where he shared a room with 6 other Irishmen. So 7 in, you know, not a large room. And he's generally, you kept your money on you on occasions like this. Keep it in your trousers, but you're unlikely to sleep with your trousers on, so that made you vulnerable. And he loses his money. Of the principal culprit, Leach indignantly complained that he came from the same country as me and slept in the same bed. He was particularly indignant about that. He obviously knew, well, half knew the chap, but he still had his money taken. So you couldn't get 7 beds in a back-to-back room, or you'd be struggling to without it being shared. So money got taken sometimes. It's also said in that report that the Birmingham Court reporters, the chap that's been sent down from the Birmingham Journal, is listening to someone with a very strong Irish accent complaining, speaking to the magistrate. It must have been really hard for that guy to pick up what was being said. I don't know how the magistrates managed it either, because the reporter on this occasion said that Leach was very eloquent on his loss, but scarcely comprehensible. He is speaking English, but obviously with a strong Irish accent. So that's one of the stories.